Good morning, Fran.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay today.
Yeah, it's a little bit drizzly out. Let me orient the listeners. I'm speaking now with Fran Dorf, who is a novelist, most notably of Flight, A Reasonable Madness, and I believe it was 2000, her book Saving Elijah, which came out to great reviews. She's also becoming something of an activist and a new blogger. So let me plug your blog right away. It is called bruisedmuse.com. That's bruised as in being black and blue. bruisedmuse.com. And we're talking with Fran today about a couple of things. One of them is that she's done some extraordinary work investigating the complex world of grief. And she shared with me a wonderful essay that's up on the web, and we'll let you know how to get to it, called Grief Support 101, How to Help a Bereaved Friend or Loved One. What drew you to think about advising people of the best way to help friends and loved ones who have been through a great big trauma or loss?
Well, Binny, when I lost my son in 1994, I was already a writer. I fell apart for a number of years, and then I wrote a novel called Saving Elijah. But through my bereavement, I found that one of the most shocking things that happens is that while most people want to help, they don't have a clue.
Mm-hmm.
They say all the wrong things. You know, they have good intentions, but they basically, you know, in thinking about all this, I feel that the main point to remember is that you don't want to say anything that delegitimizes what the bereaved person is feeling. And so a lot of people come in with these sort of cliched, you know, time will heal, God must have wanted him. And essentially what that does is makes the bereaved person feel as if the legitimate feelings he's having, the horrible feelings of grief, are illegitimate. And if only he would listen or she would listen to this person's advice, he would feel better.
And it also, it also makes it seem like it's a simple thing. And if we could just rationalize our way out of it, everything would be fine. You refer to the platitude offerers.
Right. In the article, I've thought about this for years. I divide what I call the delegitimizers into some categories.
Yeah, tell us about the categories, if you would.
The first category is the babblers. And these people will come and talk to you, and because they're so nervous, they'll start chattering about the weather or another friend who had a heart attack or, you know, that sort of thing, as if they think that the bereaved can be distracted.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, ignoring an elephant in the room just makes it bigger. And, you know, people do this for a variety of reasons. Some people chatter, you may have noticed, on and on, and they do that characteristically. But most of the time when this happens, it's about the person feeling very nervous and vulnerable.
Clearly, loss and trauma evoke anxiety in people.
Anxiety, especially, you know. And, of course, I want to just point out that these categories can be talking about people who've lost all different, you know, kinds of relationships, friends or parents. And, of course, you know, we divide grief into high and low grief. Somebody who's lost a child, you know, everybody that I've talked to would agree, probably, that the loss of a child is really the most difficult. But, you know, we don't want to get into these comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
But and then the second category are the advice givers. And these are the people who say, you know, you can have another child. You know, what you really need is a long vacation.
Ouch.
Concentrate on your other children. You know, remember the good times. Time will heal. You know, those sorts of things. In my case, I remember people would tell me, you know, there were points where I really was, you know, just completely inconsolable and just beside myself. And people would say, you know, you need to take a sedative, that sort of thing. And, you know, people mean well. But, you know, in my case, I know and I knew that I had to shed a certain number of tears. and that no pill was going to, I had to grieve and do the work of the grieving, and that no pill was going to make it so that I didn't have to do that.
Well, Fran, do you think that our fast food society that is absorbing information at such an incredible clip has something to do with this?
I think that people, this is a very spun culture, and I think we want our pain like shrink wrapped. I use the example of, you know, like the chickens on the supermarket shelves. People don't want to, you know, get really into the nitty gritty. You know, my favorite definition of compassion is a Buddhist one, willingness to be close to suffering. And, you know, people will show up, you know, for example, at a wake or you know, but the things they say sort of take them away from the suffering. The key issue really, I think, is that you want to be with, you know, and I put that in quotes, you know, learn how to be with. And sometimes that just means silence, a hand on a shoulder, you know, just being there. Well, that's one thing. And then there's also, you know, people who call and say, you know, is there anything I can do? Well, first of all, you know, people become, a bereaved person can be so bewildered and shocked and that they may not be able to think of anything. And so your, is there anything I can do, is lost on that person. Instead of that, you know, do something concrete, you know, bring dinner. Or, you know, there are lots of things that you can do within the constrict of your relationship.
You have a great phrase in here, Fran writes, remember that when the formal mourning period is over and the last casserole is gone, that was brilliant, we're still here alone and grieving. Now is a good time to show up.
Right. I think that, you know, for example, I mean, I'll talk about the Jewish way of mourning. You know, there's a 7-day period where, you know, people come, you know, and then, you know, the person's alone. The person is there, you know, and that really is the time to come. You know, there are, you know, 100 people in the house on those first 7 days. But after that, if you make your call, if you show up, if you, you know, write a note, whatever it is that you're going to do.
And that's the sitting Shiva.
Yes, and, that's the sitting shiva.
Yeah, and what are some of the other properties of that ritual? There's something about sitting low. You know, when people are doing it in a more orthodox way, they sit on boxes. Is that correct?
Yes. You know, I can't speak for that because I'm not, you know, I would call myself a secular a secular person. But
I'm,
yes,
a cultural
they sit on low
Jew.
Boxes. They rend their garments. You know, for the more reformed people, you wear a black ribbon. But a more very orthodox person. And, you know, you have to say Kaddish every day, you know, which is the prayer for the dead. And, you know, but I think that it's just really important that you, you know, don't run away. I mean, one of the categories that I had is, you know, the abandoners.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is really hard to believe. This is one of the things that shocked me the most.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that when you're bereaved, your normal way of thinking about the world, the way your ego is structured, if you will, is kind of shattered. And so you no longer know who you are. And so if people don't come around, it's sort of like kicking, you know, a wounded dog. You know what I mean? You're thinking, well, what's wrong with me? Why isn't this person showing up? But in fact, it takes work and stamina to be with somebody who's truly bereaved, because you might at any moment be the recipient of that person's anger or out-of-control emotions, and that is difficult. People are very uncomfortable with raw emotions. But if you want to continue, you know, being a friend, you know, you have to make the conscious decision to be with that person and not abandon them. You know, and you know, I remember I had one friend who was, I thought, a very, very close friend of mine. And, you know, while my son was dying, she wrote me maybe one or two notes, little notes, and then came to the funeral. Well, you know, I needed her. I needed people to help me, and she didn't come. And she, you know, and then I never spoke to her again. I still haven't spoken to her. It's, you know, probably, I don't know, 15 years now. One time I saw her in a supermarket, and she said, you know, I don't really understand why, you know, our friendship didn't go on, you know. And I said, well, you know, if you'd like me to tell you, I will. And she said, well, why don't we have lunch, and you can tell me. And I said, okay. And she said, all right, well, I'm going to be away for the week. I'll call you when I get back. And she never called. So, you know, it's shocking what happens.
Absolutely.
And then on the other hand, there are other people who instinctively know what to do or who come out of the woodwork. I mean, one of my closest friends now is somebody who really showed up, you know, who, you know, brought dinner and called and, you know, four or five times a day and, you know, and that sort of thing. So it really is a shocking experience.
And as much as there is this tendency amongst people to avoid, which, as you said, you have a fair amount of compassion for, but you certainly weren't, it was difficult to go through that. We imagine, I've noticed this of late, you know, maybe since the events of 9/11, and you talk about this a little bit in your piece, this concept of closure, you know, there's so much rapid cycling through emotional states on American TV. And I'll watch Oprah and I'll watch all those things, and these might be sometimes guilty pleasures, but there's a kind of notion that one can have a quick, very public catharsis,
right,
and then there's closure. Or these shows, you know, with Dr. Phil or whoever, where somebody confronts an abuser, and then there's closure. What is the deal with grieving and closure? Can one achieve closure? And why are we so obsessed with this notion of closure? Is it another way of trying to just package things and move on? Or is it a natural tendency among cultures to want to have some sort of finishing point? What do you think about that?
I think the word closure should be banned in relation to grief.
Yeah.
I think that anybody, I mean, I'll just speak for myself. You know, to think that I have some sort of closure, my son died 15 years ago, and to think that I might be able to get some sort of closure on that is absurd.
Mm-hmm.
The loss of my son informs me every day of my life, every single day. I think about him. I, you know, wonder what he would have been like. I occasionally cry, although not as often, you know, and it informs, it's changed the person who I am. You know, of course, I wish I had my son back, but, you know, life only goes one way, and, you know, you have to take the lessons that are brought to you, that are given to you, and I think that I'm a very different person, and so it's almost insulting, you know, when I see, you know, on the television, you know, you see these reporters who say, you know, these people have to get some closure, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, their son just was killed in Iraq or was killed in an airplane. You know, these people have to know where their, you know, where their loved ones are or whatever. They need closure. It's really horrifying.
It is.
Really,
it's offensive.
It's offensive. It's really offensive. And I think, you know, it's part of the same thing that I was talking about before, is that people, you know, they think that the key is, or maybe they habitually, you know, believe that or strive to, you know, push horrible things away in their own lives. But you can only do that until something really horrible comes, and then you know you can't push it away. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So.
And then you learn that you can't, and then you learn that this notion of willpower or distraction just isn't going to work,
right.
And you don't want people feeling like they've failed. I've known people who will say to me, well, my mother died 3 months ago, and I'm still upset. What's wrong with me? Right? And
of course you're upset.
Of course you're upset. It's only been 3 months.
Right. That's
you
right.
know, just absurd. And then, of
and
course,
imagine how it feels when somebody says to you, you know, it's really been, you know, it's only a year since your son died.
Did people say that to you?
Yes, I had one or two people actually say that to me. It's only, you know, get over it. You know, that sort of thing. What's wrong with you? You know,
wow.
One in particular that I'm thinking of. You know, you're so difficult to talk to. You know, complaining. You know, I could barely, you know, speak. I could barely get out of my bed, you know, and this person was complaining that I'm so difficult to talk to. Yeah, I probably was difficult to talk to.
Yeah.
I had a lot of anger. I put a lot of that anger in my book, you know, mm-hmm. But imagine how, you know, it's to be on the receiving end of that sort of thing, that delegitimizing, you know, like what's wrong with you kind of thing really is very hard to take, very hard to take.
Absolutely. You know, Brent, it makes me think of when people, it may be well-meaning, but certainly ignorant of the true ravages of, say, clinical depression,
right.
will say to somebody, well, why don't you just take up exercise? Or why don't you get over it? Or, you know, think of fun things, you know? And they just don't
right.
get it that, you know, in this case, depression can be a very serious process and a serious disease.
Exactly right.
You know, you mentioned a lot of anger and you mentioned your book. You did a thing that I would say a lot of people don't have access to do, which is to use their creativity. And in an amazing process, you took what you went through and you transformed it into fiction. So do people ask you about whether that was quote unquote healing or was it something you felt you just had to do? There was no way around it for your next book project.
Well, both. I would say it was both. I mean, the process by, you know, by which I wrote that novel, which did in fact incorporate my imagination into it, was not only cathartic, I would say it saved my life.
How do you mean that?
I mean it psychologically. I think that writing helps you gain access to your deepest feelings. And as a matter of fact, I've developed what I call the Write to Heal workshop, which I do with bereavement support groups and other groups, actually, you know, other traumatized people. I did one with the homeless. I did one with an addicted group, you know, and to help people access their inner world,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? And by bringing that inner world up onto the page, you know, it can help us heal. And I went through a very complicated form of that in writing the novel of Saving Elijah. Not only was the process of writing the novel cathartic or life-saving, as I said, but also the form that the novel took was, I mean, basically what I did was I created a kind of personification in the form of a ghost who appears to the protagonist in the novel, who basically asks all the questions, the really nasty questions, that the mother, the bereaved mother, would ask herself. Things like, you know, why am I being punished this way? Who accuses her? Who, you know, it's like j'accuse, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I being punished this way? What did I do wrong? Now, these are all the questions that the mother, you know, goes through in her mind, you know, accusing herself. You know, why is this horrible thing happening to me? And the ghost in the novel, you know, allowed me to use my imagination to create a character who actually poses those questions so that the reader could kind of viscerally understand, you know, what happens in grief.
And he offers the main character a Faustian dilemma.
That's right. He offers the character a way to save her son, or so she thinks. I mean, you know, the key issue is, you know, that you know, she's the only one who can see this ghost, this character, and so
ain't it always the way,
right? And so the issue is, you know, the whole thing hinges on you know, what actually happens in grief. There you really start to think you're going crazy, because, you know what I mean? And so this creating this ghost was sort of a personification of that. It's a, you know, is it real or is this just, you know, her own craziness coming out, you know, because you really do start to think you're going crazy. And so, you know, in that respect, the book, you know, both helped me intellectualize and understand what happened to me, you know, and again, I would say that this is a novel, so it's not me exactly. I think I needed to create another character to whom the same process happened, you know, the same grief process happened, so that I could, you know, sort of say to myself, I'm not the only one that this happened to. You know, this is what happens. I mean, I saw it in other bereaved people too. You know, your whole world falls apart. You know, and I needed corroboration, and I needed to show the world that this is not just Fran Dorf happening to. So I created another character with a different background, you know, and then took her through a process. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. You know, you mentioned a couple of times your world falls apart. You feel like you're going crazy. Often when we talk about trauma, we talk about the way in which it shatters assumptions that things are basically okay, we're basically safe, etc. Is that kind of what you mean about how the world seems so different and how disorienting? I mean, in addition to just the sheer sorrow, you know, and horror and missing, is it partly that the world just has to be sort of fragmented and then put back together?
Well, that's actually a very good way of looking at it, is that you have to put it back together. I like to call it, you know, and I didn't come up with this term, reinvestment. You know, after your world falls apart, you have to figure out how you're going to reinvest in life without this person, without this, you know, person that you've lost. But in terms of assumptions, I think, you know, and I'll speak specifically in this case to, you know, when you lose a child, you know, the world is supposed to operate a certain way, especially, you know, modern America. You know, if we were talking about, you know, Bangladesh, that's a whole other story. But in modern America, you know, not that many people lose a child. And so it felt to me, you know, as if the universe had shifted. You know, like, how could this happen? I can't be outliving my child. My child, in my child, represents all my hopes, all my dreams, you know, the future. And here's my child, you know, dying. And so it really violates the assumptions that you've gone through your life believing. I didn't mean to say that somebody in 1900, when it was more common for children to die, wouldn't be upset. But I'm speaking, you know, how it affected me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you mentioned how do you reinvest, and somehow what came into my mind was that scene in Beckett's play Waiting for Godot, where the phrase is repeated, I can't go on, I must go on, I can't go on, I must go on.
Exactly, that's right. I mean, I think that you make a conscious decision at some point. I mean, at least for me, and other people, you know, I mean, I've seen this. You have to make a conscious decision. I mean, you could be bereaved forever. I mean, you could, I'm still bereaved. I still consider myself a bereaved mother. But you could go on. I mean, I could have gone on, you know, sitting around, staring at the walls in my bathrobe for the next, you know, 20 years. But at some point, you know, I sort of said to myself, I can't do this anymore. It's going to be over if I continue to do this. And so I made a conscious decision to try and figure out a way to reinvest in my life. And one of the ways I did that was to write the novel. Another way I did that was to, my husband and I started a program for children with special needs in memory of our son, which is still operating. I'm very proud of it.
What's that called, that program?
Jumpstart.
Jumpstart.
Jumpstart, and
That's in Connecticut.
Yes, it's in at the Stanford Jewish Community Center. It was originally started through the Stanford Hospital, but we took it to the Jewish Community Center, and we take, you know, all kinds of children. It's not just Jewish children. We take all kinds of children from all. You know, there's a sliding scale, a scholarship program set up for, you know, because I'm very concerned about, you know, the educational piece for toddlers, that they, my child had special needs, and I saw how helpful the educational piece was. And this, I believe, is the only program of its kind in the state. This is very complicated, but the Birth of Three program used to fund this. And now, you know, when I came back into the world and, you know, and saw the Birth Three state program is not funding this anymore, so we set up this Jumpstart program. We have 30 children with challenges of all kinds, you know, autism and, you know, and all different kinds of issues. And I'm very proud of it. That was another way I reinvested. And another way I reinvested is that I, you know, I've sort of been, you know, I've gotten to be more of an activist, actually, about different issues, you know, about, you know, children's issues and all kinds of issues.
And that makes a good segue to something I want to ask you about. And just to briefly orient the listeners, we are talking with novelist and activist Fran Dorf about grief and other topics. The radio station is WPKN in Bridgeport and WPKM Montauk. You recently got involved with Amnesty International, and I think it makes a perfect segue because so much of what Amnesty International deals with is the issue of human rights, and human rights has within it a tremendous amount of loss and suffering and grieving because of all the violations of human rights that they're trying to police across the globe. So just tell us a little bit about that and your interest in that.
Well, I was very honored to have been invited by Kerry Kennedy, who I met. I had a political event in my house, but we won't go into that. Well, I met her, and she has written an incredible. She's one of the children of Bobby Kennedy, and she's gone around the world and interviewed all kinds of people whose human rights have been violated and who are human rights activists, as she is. And she invited me to attend the Executive Directors Leadership Council, which is basically a conference in Washington, D.C. last weekend. And it was the most incredible experience. You know, and of course there were panels where people, you know, were discussing the various horrifying violations of human rights that are going on all over this world. But the thing that impressed me the most were the firsthand accounts. We heard a General Jose Gallardo, I'm not sure if I pronounced his name right, from Mexico, who had been jailed for 8 years for writing a master's thesis about corruption in the Mexican government. I mean, jailed, tortured, you know, horrible, horrible stories. We heard about the violations that are going on all over this world of women's rights. The United States is, we're urging passage of the International Violations Violence Against Women Act, which is currently being considered in Congress. And I heard testimony from a woman named Betty McConey, who of Zimbabwe, who was, you know, horribly abused and now runs a network for women in Zimbabwe, telling her tale. You know, most people turn away from this sort of stuff.
Absolutely.
You know, it's very hard.
It's hard to hear these things. It's hard to just sit and listen to the details.
It's very hard to hear these things. I don't know why I think I can hear them. You know, maybe because I've suffered myself, I feel like I can hear them. I've become, you know, very incensed about all this. You know, particularly the fact that the United States government has become like the torturers we condemn.
Mm.
I mean, there's basic concept camp going on in Guantanamo Bay. President Bush says these people are the worst of the worst. In fact, they're not. I heard Congressman Jim Moran of Virginia at a lobbying session on Capitol Hill say, you know, these people were basically captured by Pakistanis when the United States was offering, you know, bounties on their heads. Well, you know, you offer that in America, and you could set up a concentration of Americans, you know, if you pay somebody $5,000 to turn people in.
Yeah.
You know, and they're there for years without charges. I mean, what sort of way of life are we defending if people can be held like this without habeas corpus and, you know, sent to countries that torture and, you know, participating in torture, you know? I just so outraged that I, you know, and I started my blog, my main subject is grief, but I've hijacked myself in the last, you know, I've been writing on amnesty and about all these issues. It was really a fascinating, I didn't realize, I guess, how formal it was. You know, we sat across the table from these congressmen, you know, and their assistants, and we, you know, actually, you know, spoke in support of these issues, you know, asking them to, you know, pass the International Violence Against Women Act, and it was really...
Sounds like it was a very transformational event. They're lucky to have you because you seem ideally suited, as you said, because of your own experiences. You're not going to turn away. You're going to be able to be present to some of these testimonies, and even through blogging about it, draw attention to much needed issues, and people can go onto the web and look up Amnesty International and see in what ways they can participate. It has been great to talk to you, and I hope maybe we will do it again because I have more questions.
Oh, okay. Thanks so much. It was great.
Good. And I'll just say again, this is Fran Dorf, whose novels include Flight, A Reasonable Madness, and Saving Elijah. The name of her blog is bruisedmuse.com. And it's full of very interesting things. So I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.